This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Jeannie Oakes, a professor emerita from UCLA, who has recently written a policy brief entitled Community Schools, an Evidence-Based Strategy for Equitable School Improvement. Jeannie, welcome. And to begin with, what is a community school?
Well, thank you. That's a research question that we asked as we were preparing this brief, and a much longer monograph that's about to come out in mid-December, because there are a great diversity of schools that call themselves community schools. Some of them are just a regular school, an ordinary school that puts community school on its name and likes to think of itself as a friendly community place. But so as we review the literature on community schools and read everything we could about every community school we could, we realized that there were four things that really stuck out as being core to the approach, even if the community schools look very different in different places. So let me tell you the four. The first characteristic is that they have integrated student supports. That means they have connections either on campus or with providers off campus to make sure that kids get the health and well-being, extra support they need. So they may get eye exams and or dental exams or referrals to social workers. But a deliberate effort to put everything together in this site. So the school is a hub for all of the social and health services that a child or a family might need. But that's not all. A lot of people think that's all it is the school that has those supports. But we found three other things that were extremely important. One is that they offer expanded learning time and opportunities, and that can be a whole variety of things like longer school days, Saturday programs, lots of after-school programming, summer programming, but they are giving children opportunities to learn in time beyond the ordinary school day and in ways that go beyond ordinary curriculum and instruction. So expanded learning time and opportunities. The third is that families and communities are engaged, and they're engaged in very meaningful ways and lots of diverse ways. It's not simply calls home, but it's actually families and community members being part of the school community. And finally, community schools are much more collaborative in the way they are run and in the kind of practices that take place in schools. So teacher professional learning communities are very characteristic of community schools. So our definition of a community school was a school that has either all or most of those elements wrapped up in a single package.
Thanks. It's a comprehensive definition. I'm curious about whether community schools are a new educational innovation or whether they've been around for a while.
Well, actually, they're about 100 years old, and they trace all the way back to Jane Addams and Hull House in Chicago and many other community schools or community centers at that time that really tried to integrate learning opportunities and services for low-income people, generally immigrants, who are newly arrived in urban centers. And it's pretty surprising because if you go back and look at what Jane Addams did and others like her, there was also a real sense of needing to be culturally responsive and collaborative and engaging community members as sources of knowledge rather than just as clients. So this is a very old idea. What's interesting is that over time, the idea has shifted. And when they were first started, community schools were really thought about ways to strengthen neighborhoods and strengthen democracy by integrating newcomers in and giving them the supports and education that will make the community stronger. Over time, and it's not surprising given the era we live in now, they've been thought of as strategy for improving student outcomes. And generally today, that's a sort of a test that community schools have to pass, is that they can improve students' academic achievement, reduce dropout rates, reduce disciplinary problems, increase attendance. Those are the kinds of things that we look to community schools to do today.
Sounds like a really powerful innovation. How common are community schools now in the United States?
Well, they're growing by the day. It's very interesting. They've been around for a while, and there's some innovations. Probably the most sort of a seminal example of the recent batch of community schools started in the 1980s with James Comer and his notion that young people's health and well-being that used to be accommodated and taken care of by close, trusting relationships among neighbors and communities was not really characteristic of neighborhoods, especially for very poor children, in the 1980s. So his whole school child development model really started the most recent wave of interest in trying to integrate a whole range of services that try to compensate for some of the harms of poverty within the school setting by making the school a hub in the neighborhood. But today we have big community schools initiatives in Chicago, in New York City, Philadelphia. I just heard the other day that the new superintendent of Houston is about to implement 15 community schools in Houston, and that actually he was partly chosen to be superintendent because he's a community school guy. He knows this area. So it's very much growing in popularity.
So why did you decide to study them at this point in time? And who do you imagine being the audience for the synthesis of research about community schools?
The question came to us through our connections with grassroots community groups. Both NEPC and the Education Justice Network, which NEPC is part of, have a real commitment to listening to people on the ground and to engage and learn from them about what problems are most pressing from their perspective and what kinds of solutions seem to make sense to them in their communities. And so we were approached actually by Journey for Justice, which is a grassroots nationwide movement, and other local groups saying, we don't like school closures. We think there's enough evidence to say that school closures aren't working to improve education opportunities for our kids. We would rather have community schools as a strategy where local communities and educators could work together to create places in neighborhoods that were both good schools and very much centers for families. And so the question was, well, what do we know about this? Is this a good idea? This is a very appealing idea, but do we know anything about the effectiveness? And so we started noodling that question, and then we were looking at the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and saw that there was a special grants program in it for community schools, but also realized that if community schools had the required evidence base, it could also be used as a strategy under Title I for improving the lowest performing schools. So we really went about this with two ideas in mind, that we wanted to give as much useful information as we could about what the research says to people like the Journey for Justice folks, like the superintendents in New York and Philly and Houston, who were interested in developing community schools. But we also wanted to see if it could pass the test. For an intervention to be funded with Title I funds, it has to meet a very precise evidence standard. So So there has to be at least one well-designed study, and ESSA defines how those, what kinds of studies they consider well-designed, that shows the positive benefit. So one of our questions was, could this pass muster? And if so, this might be a very good use of Title I money, and a place where federal policy and local interests might actually coincide in some good ways. So that's what set us off on our path about a year ago.
Great, thank you. Given your interest in finding schools that would pass muster, I think looking back at your policy group, you discussed the way in which the four pillars that you identified as characteristic of community schools actually well match many of the characteristics of effective schools. Could you say more about that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, one of the things that we knew is that the silver bullet notion of an intervention isn't a very robust one, that there's no sort of magical formula of being able to implement something and voila, you have sort of the reform fairy produces these great outcomes, and that you, but it's still a black box. So we thought it's very important that when we look at these characteristics of community schools to begin to think about why is it that these four characteristics that we named, the services, support services for kids, the expanded learning time, the family and community engagement and collaboration, would lead to better outcomes. And we reviewed the increasing amount of literature that's available about, well, what is it? What are the characteristics of schools that seem to help children perform better than others? And it's not surprising. I mean, we were surprised and very interested to find out that, in fact, the qualities that were well-known and well-documented to have positive effects on students' outcomes are very much the kind of things that these four pillars create in schools. So in a way, it's sort of a two-step process that you put these community school pillars in place, and then you create the conditions about the kind of teaching and learning, paying attention to the whole child, that you provide supports when kids need it. There's a climate of safety and trusting relationships, and learning is a high priority, and strong family ties, and a culture of teacher collaboration and professional learning. All of those things come up over and over again in the literature as what makes schools high quality. And it turns out that these four pillars of community schools, especially in underserved communities where families can't do a lot of supplementing of what schools provide, and there may not be many enrichment opportunities easily available outside of school, that these pillars really do help schools construct settings that that can make them very much like what the literature says effective schools are like.
So you ended up investigating a variety of different studies that kind of looked at the impact of community schools. What does that evidence show about their effect on student learning and the capacity to overcome some of the consequences of poverty for low-income children?
Well, what we did was we looked separately at all four of those pillars because, again, we didn't want to treat the community school as a black box. But we said, okay, what do we know about these four things? And do they really have a benefit? And if so, what kind of a benefit? And then we looked at all of the research that on community schools themselves, where research that's looked at places that have kind of pulled these four things together, and to see what the research says about that. We think that's very important that we use both kinds of research because the evidence base on community schools is mostly evaluation studies that have been done in particular places. Whereas these other elements, if you want to look at wraparound services or expanded learning time, family engagement, these things have been well studied for a very long time. And in fact, the evidence based on community schools and the pillars taken together really provides quite, and people should be very confident about the strategies, that the evidence base really does justify the use of community schools. And it both for helping kids succeed academically and to help them prepare for full and productive lives. So the, it turns out that the things that advocates have said about improved attendance, reduced disciplines, create better relationships between families and schools, strong ties, that, that kids seem to be more engaged in learning, that those things all do turn out to be the case. And what's interesting as well is that we found in each of the research on each of the four pillars and research on schools that have pulled it all together, that in each of those five areas, there's a, there is at least and more than one well-designed study that demonstrates the positive impact. So we felt quite confident in saying that community schools could meet the standards for being used for the use of Title I funds.
You talk about the importance of effective implementation of community schools for these benefits to be realized. And it, it reminded me of a project that I was involved in studying back in the 1990s, supported by the Annie Casey Foundation, that incorporated many of the characteristics of community schools. One of the challenges we encountered, however, was that although many of the structures were brought into the schools that were the recipients of these funds, not enough was done to actually begin to change the culture of the classroom and the culture of the school, so that the kind of trusting relationships that you indicated earlier that seemed really critical to the success of these programs was oftentimes absent. Did you see anything happening in the research studies that kind of showed ways in which the culture of the school was changed?
There's not a lot of research about that, which I think is really unfortunate. There is one really interesting study of the community schools in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that a researcher named Kurt Adams did. And he studied not only whether the Tulsa Community Schools Initiative as a whole worked, he looked separately at schools that had really done a good job of implementing all of the features and doing so with an intensity that they really became not add-on things to a school, but they really did transform the school. And his research found that in those schools, those fully implemented schools, there was a level of trust that seemed to be the mediator between these structures and the more positive outcomes that they found in those schools. Those schools, not surprisingly, well-implemented schools did much better on the outcome measures than the schools that were only superficially or implemented or treated it more as an add-on kind of reform.
So the structural...
So trust seems to be very important. Uh-huh. And, you know, this is Tony Breich and others who studied Chicago schools for such a long time have really written about this over the last 15 years, that this whole notion of relational trust, not just between kids and adults, but between the adults and one another and between the school adults and families, are all critical variables in school effectiveness.
So at least in some instances, structural changes lay the foundation for these shifts in culture as well. It seems like community schools are a powerful reform initiative, but I can imagine a few objections. For example, couldn't creating community schools as a means for dealing with the consequences of poverty lead us to believe that educational innovations are enough to rectify these deep social and economic problems? Isn't there a danger that rather than actively dealing legislatively with income disparity and discrimination in this country head on, we could just create community schools and the opportunities to learn they bring with them, and then figure that we've done enough?
Yeah, that is a complex and a very naughty question, because in fact, it is so multi-layered. Let me... First of all, if you only do, the evidence is not I mean, the evidence is clear that the combination of these features of schools are what makes a difference. So it's both creating the high quality conditions as well as mitigating the harms of poverty. So it's not just bringing in kind of services. I mean, although that's a good thing, but it's more than that. It also has to be about teaching and learning, and that's a critical part of it. And we could say tons more about that. So that not every community schools, I mean, community schools, I think, that really have a poor things attitude and really do just try to soften the blow of poverty without attending to high-quality curriculum instruction aren't doing anybody a great service in terms of equitable access to high-quality schooling. On the other hand, I've always been such an advocate of integrated schools and believe very strongly in the power of racial diversity for creating wonderful learning environments. I've worked on this my whole life. And so in some ways, coming to community schools is saying, well, this is sort of accepting the fact that we're going to have racially segregated neighborhoods and we're going to have concentration of poverty. And what can we do given that circumstance? So it is a big dilemma for people like me who both want to have great schools for all kids in every neighborhood and also really believe in the power of racial integration. It's not as much a problem for a lot of activists of color. It's really interesting who say, look, this society won't do desegregation and won't do it in a way that provides good things for our kids. And so often when there are desegregation initiatives, they're designed to benefit the white kids. So who needs that? So it's a very interesting set of dilemmas around those larger social questions.
Could you say more about the high quality teaching and learning you've seen in the most effective community schools? What does this look like?
Well, what's interesting is the high-quality teaching and learning really comes from a combination of these other pillars being in schools. So, for example, the fact that they have relationships with other partners and have strong engagement of community members really helps them provide what they like to call community-based curriculum. And the best of that community-based curriculum that I've seen is where the after-school programming or the out-of-school programming is very nicely aligned with what goes on in classrooms, but it also has a number of other characteristics, more like project-based learning, having a chance to apply what you learn to real world settings. So kids are often out in communities doing learning, either as apprenticeships with community members or in research projects on community issues or community problems. Kids tend to work together on these kinds of projects rather than individually. And when you kind of add it all up, you can see that this structure and the practices in community schools make possible the kind of learning that increasingly learning scientists are saying is really important in settings if kids are going to be able to do deep learning, critical thinking, the kinds of things that we expect everyone will need for the rest of this 21st century. So it's not as though the structures put in place in community schools guarantee these outcomes, but like many other things, they provide the people, the spaces, the time, and the incentives because of the relationship for these community-based learning experiences, which the best of them are just quite spectacular.
Since these schools really do promise a way to more effectively improve the chances of low-income students to become educationally successful, what factors need to be in place to make them work?
Well, I think The secret sauce in a community school is really the culture that gets built in the school, that the only way that really high expectations and high quality opportunities are provided are when the culture is one that says, these students are smart, these parents really care about their kids and want high quality learning for them. Teachers feel like we know how to work with these kids. We know these kids can learn, and we have the additional resources and support of the community to make that happen. I think that's the magic, if there is any. If community schools are just thought of as places that have a lot of extra health services or social supports for needy clients, and that the professionals are really in charge and see themselves as dispensing help rather than on supporting the full development of students and families and neighborhoods, we won't get the most outstanding results that we know are possible.
So what about the current policy environment is really kind of opening up the door to the creation of more of these community schools?
Well, there are certainly opportunities. Right now, the ESSA includes a Title IV for community school projects, but those, unfortunately, were zeroed out in the Trump administration budget proposal. So those are very much at risk as the 21st century learning communities that provide so much of the support for after school programs. I think they may have fought their way back in as the budget is being considered, but who knows where that will go. But the policy opportunities are really at the state level, where states can create enabling policies or smooth the way for combining resources in a way that makes developing these complex places possible. But the real action is really in local communities, in local school districts and local school boards, trying to figure out ways to make sure that their policies really encourage rather than create barriers to these kind of schools.
So to conclude, what recommendations would you have for policymakers with regard to community schools and their more widespread implementation?
Well, that would be a better question to ask me in 6 months. The next piece of work that we're undertaking at the Learning Policy Institute is, and with the partnership of NEPC as well, is to create a policy toolkit. And we're in the process now of talking to everybody we know at federal, state, and local policy levels to find examples of policies that have been used, to think about what might model policy language be like, and to really create a toolkit that can be used by people who want to move ahead and want to make policy that enables this. Right now, there are some good resources. Probably the best resources at the Coalition for Community Schools, where on their website, they have implementation guidelines. They have a number of recommendations for how the kinds of policies that would enable and promote good implementation. So I suggest that folks go there, the Coalition for Community Schools, and take a look at their very rich set of resources.
Thanks much, Jeannie, for your insights into this important issue. And thanks to our listeners for joining us for this podcast. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. January's Education Interview of the Month will be with Linda Molnar Kelly and Adam York at the University of Colorado Boulder. They are leading the Schools of Opportunity Project that recognizes high schools that have instituted changes in curriculum and climate capable of drawing young people, often marginalized in conventional classrooms, into a sense of school membership and engagement. Many of these schools have also adopted some of the characteristics of the community schools discussed today. We invite you to join us again for January's podcast.